Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to you all. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Mudio Gavaza, and for today, we are getting into the world of digital payments. There's this ongoing war against cash, various players in the financial services industry, banks, fintechs, and the likes. But with the increasing digitization of cash, and payments comes an increased risk, increased cybersecurity and fraud, risk on that end, people sitting in the background and wanting to steal, our money or other nefarious activities from us, because all of this stuff is happening in the digital process. So today we are joined by Chris Boxall, who is the head of Card Transact and Fraud Detection at FNB. And we're hoping that, through this conversation, he's going to help to educate us just around what's going on. And I guess some of the ways in which people can either mitigate or, completely, not expose themselves in this regard. Chris, greetings to you today.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
You know where I want to start today, Chris, is in the war against cash, right? How much of a deterrent has the security aspect been around how people decide to use digital payments or to just stay with their traditional under the pillow, I've got my physical cash in hand, type of situation in South Africa?
Sure. I think there are a lot of misnomers about cash and how easy it is. Everyone says cash is king, and it very much is. And that's from a speed, convenience point of view, and it's readily available around us. But the problem with cash is once it's gone, it's gone. So, and unlike the card or banking world and various payments there, where you have an ability to try and chase down the person that has it, trying to tell, a policeman or an authority that somebody just took all of your cash straight off your person, you'd like to find a way to get it back. Chances are that cash is gone by the time you try get to that person. Whereas in the banking world, you've at least got the ability to track down, the various accounts and the payments that are being made in the digital world. But to your point, I think security is a big part of making payments today and doing the day-to-day payments, goods and services that customers make use of. It comes down to what is safe enough for me to do. I was actually having a discussion with a colleague yesterday that's saying that they prefer to do cash on delivery for all of their online shopping because they're very worried about typing their card number into the wrong place. And I said, I can understand that, from a wallet and phishing point of view. However, there's certain steps that we need to take. If you make sure you're at the right merchant on an app, on a website, and you can see that the website is correct, the right URL or website address is in the browser, or you've downloaded the app directly from the app store and you can see it's verified, there's no reason to be worried that your information is going to be phished. And in that regard, we say to customers, double check the amount you're being charged for. Make sure you authenticate in app. There are often times where a website won't send you an in-app authentication or an OTP, as we call it, a one-time PIN. And in that regard, it's also still safe to continue with the transaction because it means that you as the customer have the rights to get your money back should your transaction be fraudulent or questioned or disputed in the future. So a lot of people wait for that PIN to come through or the in-app authentication. Sometimes it doesn't occur, and customers can rest assured that if they don't authenticate using that OTP, they're still safe because then the merchant is taking that risk for that transaction. So it does form a big part of how we fight cash today. As we go more digital, I think the logic is you can't use cash for everything. If I'm paying somebody thousands of miles away, if I'm paying for an app subscription of Netflix, Spotify, the likes, you can't just use cash to make that payment. You need to be digitally enabled, and it allows you to make purchases far beyond what you can today in your local environment.
Well, more than anything else, like what you said just now, for people that are participating in the digital economy, You almost have no choice but to use cash in certain instances. I do know that in some areas, a person might not have, you know, a direct, you know, account themselves. They go to some intermediary and then they give that person cash, who then pays for certain things on their behalf. But there is a digital element that you sort of have to be comfortable with in 2024. And that comes with a number of the risks that you spoke about just now. You know, people being, you know, fed some of these fake OTP requests and, you know, all of that stuff. When it comes to, I guess, something like that, because of the position that you are in, right? Apart from the OTP type of requests, you know, when we talk about in the world of cybersecurity, there are only a couple of vectors, you know, through which people tend to breach either organizations, businesses, or individuals, right? We talk about phishing, smishing, social engineering, you know, password hacking, all of these things. Like, the number of things that they can do, there's a limited number of things that they can do, but, you know, there's a lot of growing sophistication around how they get you to interact with one of these things. How has that developed, you know, in the world of card and digital? Obviously, you've told us about OTP as one of the ways in which people are now convincing consumers, you know, that there's a legitimate payment request that's about to be processed. What are some of the typical, I guess, downfalls or shortfalls or ways in which people are getting attacked out there?
Sure. I think many moons ago, the card itself was probably the point of least resistance when it came to fraudsters and scamsters. Thinking back to the magstripe and being able to copy it, create counterfeit cards, and then run around with 10 versions of Chris's card where I could get funds out, you know. And what we're seeing with the EMV chip, as well as, you know, the online authentication in app, it's unfortunately removed it from being a technology problem to now a social engineering problem. And I think you touched nicely on phishing, vishing, smishing. So maybe, I know you've got tech-savvy listeners, but maybe just to explain that a bit better. Phishing, put simply, is a scamster or fraudster that's trying to get you to compromise your information. If it's over the phone, that's generally called vishing. If they're sending you an SMS with a link, that's called smishing. And phishing is the general term just about the scamster trying to find a way to get you to hand over sometimes your username and password, but most of the time your card number, your PIN, or your expiry and your CVV number that's on your card. And then what they'll also do is they'll keep you on the phone, enter those details into a website, into a wallet, into various things, and then they will wait for the OTP to be sent to you as if you're completing an online purchase, and then they will request you to share that OTP with them over the phone. Now, logically, all of this is layered. They don't just do so upfront. They play some banking background music to make it sound legitimate. They tell you that there's a fraud attack on your account, and please could you give them 16 digits of your card number so they can quickly chase it. They just want to check the expiry and the CVV. If it's correct, then you hand that over. And then they say, please, will you authenticate yourself by providing us with the OTP? Now sitting, you know, looking at it from a high level, you can see that you're just handing over your card details. But at the moment of stress, you're worried about your account. You don't think that you're actually handing over your card details. You think you're authenticating yourself as a customer. And I think, to your point on what are the other layers of protection there, the banks will not ask a customer for their card details over the phone. We won't ask you. In fact, we suggest that you never share those card details unless you're entering it on a website or a wallet to complete a purchase. We have other mechanisms of authenticating the customer to say, you know, I'd rather authenticate an app, but you don't have to hand us an OTP. You don't have to do a purchase to authenticate yourself. And customers are getting caught in this trap more and more. So to the best of our ability, the bank's putting in barriers, levels of angst, making sure that if you want to load your card into Apple Pay or Samsung Pay, you know, you have to accept our T's and C's. You've got to go through the scam alerts that we're highlighting to you if you are on the phone right now with somebody you don't know and you're enrolling a card in a wallet, please stop and rethink. And people will go through the whole process and still get to the end and realize they've been scammed. So I think to your point, the layers that we've put in over the years in the system have now shifted to us having to manage additional barriers to normal usage of the product, trying to highlight to customers where they may be in a social engineering scenario. And due to stress, they're trying to actually authenticate themselves. But in the background, they're actually handing over their card details.
You know, when you're talking just now about being on the phone and never having to give your card details, I'm happy that, you know, the banks have evolved in this particular realm, because I've had a number of conversations, you know, around some of these things, and you also see some of the advice coming through from the banks around this particular issue. But I will say from experience that I have had in the past, a couple of years ago, for certain type of requests or certain types of queries, there's certain of your personal banking information that you had to give over on the phone, you know, for them to authenticate who you are and then, you know, start processing your request. And I'm happy that now at least there are other layers, you know, where you can authenticate a call through, you know, maybe a banking app or something like that, as opposed to you saying your details, you know, over the phone. But I've heard a couple of interesting things, you know, Chris, when it comes to the fake websites, because it does seem as if a big part of, I guess, the scamming MO is making people believe that they're transacting with a legitimate, you know, website platform or, you know, user interface that's online. But I think in the United States, I've seen very interesting situations where a person thinks that they are tapping their card on a normal POS, but there's actually like a device on top of a device.
I
don't know. Yeah.
Maybe I'm happy to chat about that. I think there's a few MOs doing the rounds. With the fake websites, we've seen an uptick in the number of fake websites that look very legitimate. And the only way in which you can tell the difference generally is the actual address. And that's why we suggest to customers, if there's any sort of like spidey senses tingling that something's not right, copy the address, put it into Google, and see that it is the legitimate, you know, address of that company, or double check, make a call if you're not feeling. I know most people doing online shopping don't want to make calls to check in, but we do say rather be vigilant than hand over your details. It's very difficult. When we do find fake websites, we do provide it to the authorities to take down as quickly as possible. And then to your point on the point of sale devices, for many years, there's been this thought or perspective in market that there are a lot of people running around with these merchant devices and kind of either holding one device on top of another, or we've seen the video where, you know, somebody runs up to behind somebody, holds it against their pockets on their pants, and because their cards are there, that the transaction goes through. In South Africa today, that's probably the fraud MO we see the least of. And I think it's because of the onboarding controls they have when you need to get a device. It's far easier for a fraudster to set up a fake website or act as a call center agent than it is to go through the rigmarole of getting a point of sale and then trying to run around and get unsuspecting victims by tapping, especially when you need a PIN above a certain value. You know, it's just not worth the time. So we don't see much of that. And where we do, and we have seen, let's say, two or three cases in the last few months, but we raise it with the bank, whether it's ourselves or another bank who's provided the point of sale, and that merchant is very quickly removed from the ecosystem and the customers are refunded because it's legitimate fraud. So we are aware that people are worried about not having their PIN. At the same time, they are protected from those types of MOs from a liability point of view, and the bad players are very quickly removed. So we don't see much of that fraud. It's the cyberspace where we do see the fraud as everyone goes digital. It's, as we mentioned, the fake websites, the SMSs about your parcels arriving and asking for an additional customs fee, and you go through the whole link into your details because you don't want it to get stuck at customs. And then all of a sudden you realize that a whole bunch of transactions are coming off of your account because you're authorizing them. It's items like that that I think are the big problem in our market at the moment, and one that are hard to defend against when we're handing away the details.
All right. And it is quite interesting, I guess, that point that you make now to say that that because of the admin, that's the word I'm going to use, the admin that it takes to actually register and actually get some of these POS devices and that type of thing, that your criminal actors would rather go, you know, in the cyberspace. You know, you've got less resistance, less friction, and you can easily probably get up and going as long as you have something that looks legitimate. One of the things that we're always keen to get a sense of is size, scope, and scale, right? Because it's one thing to tell people that, you know, you could potentially lose some money, you know, here and there, but it's quite something else to maybe make people understand how big the issue is, or how, you know, how potentially bad and traumatizing it can be. Are there any case studies or any data points you could share with us just about how bad this can be for either an individual, you know, or a business? Like how much can or has ever been taken away from a person, you know, through some of these means?
Sure. I think when in fraud, everything's relative, right? So as much as I'd love to share, you know, we spend X million on trying to solve for the fraud, and X million is taken from individuals on a daily basis. That could be one event for a very, very wealthy person, or could be a life savings for, you know, let's say an entry level or new to banking type of individual. So I would always say that the fraud value is insignificant as opposed to the fraud event itself. At FNB, we do have hundreds to thousands of these events occurring on a monthly and annual basis as customers are taken advantage of. And it's more the number of cases that we're seeing and the escalation thereof that makes us worried, because it takes one approval of an OTP for either R1,000 to go through or R1,000,000. And customers always say, but why would you allow that spend? We would allow that spend based on your spend behavior. If you're one of the wealthiest individuals in the country and you would spend R1,000,000 in a day, and you do go spend R1,000,000 in a day, it's very difficult to detect that as fraud. Whereas, you know, on someone else's account who doesn't spend more than R3,000 a month, when you see a R200 transaction come through, it's very hard to determine if that's groceries for the week, for the month, or if that's actually a fraudulent transaction. If it comes in higher than their normal spend, then we'll be able to identify and block. But it's kind of, the values are almost insignificant. It's when the event occurs that we're trying to stop and trying to manage the customer experience.
I periodically get those types of, you know, notifications if perhaps, you know, I'm buying something once off. That is unusual. And, you know, after a couple of days or on the day, you'll get a notification to say, was this indeed you? And did you make this particular transaction? But maybe you could just talk to us about that part to say that with some of these cases, it's not necessarily that you're being attacked once off. In certain cases, someone is actually sitting for some time and perhaps studying, you know, your buying and purchasing behavior before they actually initiate an attack.
Absolutely. So what we do from an F&B perspective is there's a lot of proactive prevention, right? We will try and stop transactions that are coming to you as a customer before you even are made aware of them, if it seems outside of your spend behavior. Then what we do is we also pick up, if something seems suspicious, we would normally block, but we actually want to give you the benefit of the doubt and say, Can you confirm yourself if this is legitimate or not? We'll actually send you an in-app notification and say, we're 50-50 here. If it is you, let us know, and then we'll allow that transaction through. And then you get cases where, unfortunately, you know, customer approves in-app, you know, they've done the e-commerce, they've gone through the whole process of loading a digital wallet. And it's very difficult for us to pick that up because the customer is authenticating it, but we'll still send them after the fact a suspicious transaction message and say, although you've completed this transaction, maybe just let us know if at the time you were aware that you were actually fulfilling a transaction type. So I guess there's various mechanisms to stop a customer from handing away their funds. And I guess we try and approach it from a proactive as well as possibly a reactive point of view, just to double check, you know, that they're making the right spend and that it is legitimately them. So there are various measures in place to try and manage that.
I'd be guessing that this is where, you know, technologies like AI and machine learning would probably be at play, you know, on the banking side, just to monitor, you know, the types of transactions that are typical, spending patterns and that type of thing. But I wanted to maybe take a deeper dive. We've spoken about e-commerce transactions. We've spoken about OTP. We've spoken about point of sale devices and merchants. But obviously, the digital wallets is a big piece of it. And whether a person is on Apple Pay, Google Pay, Samsung Pay, whatever pay, right, there tends to be an advertisement, that's the word I'm going to use, on the side of the third parties, you know, that would tell you about how great their platforms are, how secure their platforms are and all that. But it does seem, at least from what you've spoken about up to now, that a person could even be intercepted in the process of loading their card onto one of these, on one of these platforms.
Absolutely. I think if we look at the way we're digitizing today, I think it's a great thing. Personally, myself, I haven't used my physical card since the last time I had to go through a toll gate, which was probably a month or two ago. You know, so I use my watch to tap for various items. I use my phone to tap. And with that comes a lot of convenience. But there's also the risk of, at the point of enrolling your card in that wallet, if you are intercepted, it makes it even more difficult for the bank to understand that you have been intercepted unless you report it accordingly. And the reason for that is all of these new devices use things like live detection. You know, is it on the person's arm? Has a person provided a warm finger biometrics onto the device to ensure that they are correct? But what these fraudsters will do is they'll convince you to hand over your card details, as I mentioned earlier. They will load it onto their device, onto the fraudster's device. So the fraudster will sit with an Apple phone, for example. They will get Chris to divulge his information over the phone. They will enter my card number into their device. And they will also get me to provide them with the OTP over the phone. I hope I don't fall for this in future, but just as an example. And I then will accept, you know, that they have enrolled my card in their device. Thereafter, they're using biometrics to authenticate my transactions because I've given away all of the card information and allowed it to be enrolled. And I think that's where customers need to be super careful and vigilant going forward. They need to read the messages, the OTPs, the process of, am I enrolling this in my own phone? Am I enrolling it in someone else's, a daughter, a brother, you know, a partner? Am I sharing my card details? Make sure that I have the right wallet. And that I don't do so under false pretenses, right? I should only want to enroll a card when I want to. No one should prompt me on a phone call via an email, SMS. So we need to actually be better at using this new tech, reading the messages that come up, making sure the platforms are legitimate, verified, Google Play Store, Apple Play Store, whatever, iStore. We need to make sure that we're getting the things from a correct location, we're using the right platforms, and we're double checking when we first enter the platform that it's correct, as opposed to worrying about the security of it later on when the transaction comes through. Because by then you've already entered, you know, a counterfeit or a fake website and you're giving away your details. When you type in your address, your name, it's just giving fraudsters more and more information about you that they can then use in the phone call pretending to be the bank.
Quick one, just as a follow-up to what you're saying. Let's say I'm using one of the platforms. And I've loaded my card, you know, has been loaded onto a third party's phone. You know, the criminal has my card loaded onto their Samsung Pay, Apple Pay, whatever it is, that's there, right? when it comes to actual payments, how are they, I think that's the part that's not immediately clear. How are they authenticating the actual payments when they tap or whatever it is? Tap, scan a QR code, whatever that part is. How are they authenticating? Because usually with those platforms, you're either, you know, doing a retina scan, you know, of your eye, or you're doing biometrics with your fingerprint. Like, how are they doing it on the other side?
So with regards to a card transaction, there are various ways to verify yourself. Okay, back in the day, we had signature, which in a very honest and highly moral environment is perfectly fine, because, you know, you write your signature and you leave. And then as the years went by, they realized that that signature doesn't do the job. We moved to PIN. The PIN used to be stored on the magstripe, so you could actually never change your PIN. And most people think they've always been able to, but actually there was a time where they couldn't, and their PIN was their PIN. Then we moved to actual changeable PIN. So on your app, you were able to manage that, and every customer can authenticate their card present transaction using their PIN. And now, as devices have gotten cleverer, using your facial biometrics or your fingerprint is actually far safer than PIN, because we know the person that's linked behind it, right? So when you're walking up to a terminal, Pick and Pay, a Checkers, etc., you're actually entering a passcode on the phone, which replaces your PIN at the terminal, or even using biometrics, facial biometrics, fingerprint, in order to complete that. So what I'm trying to say is, from a bank point of view, you're using those various mechanisms to authenticate yourself. From a terminal point of view, they're not too worried about who you are, because the bank's giving the final approval of your transaction and making sure you have the funds. And we're using these various means of PIN, biometrics, in the old days signature, to make sure that you are who you are. So we need to also make sure that when you start loading your card in various places, talking to the upfront provisioning of the card or loading of the card, we need to make sure you're doing it in the right place and you understand where you're loading it, because we can't track every merchant website or wallet in the world of where you're sharing your details. You need to make sure it's legitimate, and we have to trust that you're providing us with the correct authentication mechanism or validation that it is actually you loading that card.
I think the part I'm still not fully understanding is, I guess, you know, I'm going to give you my understanding of the situation, and then you'll tell me whether I'm right or wrong. If someone intercepts a loading of a card onto one of these platforms, they end up, let's just use iPhones because that's easy, they end up putting my card onto their iPhone, because they have their biometrics set on the phone and they've put my card details. Then it's their own biometrics that are now authenticating my card, because my card was enrolled onto their device, quote unquote, in a legitimate way. Am I understanding that piece correctly?
That is correct. I think the point here is, let's take the digital wallet out of the scenario. Okay. And you wanted to give your mother, sister, or brother a card to go and do shopping on your behalf. We'd say, here's my card. On a little note, you'll write down the PIN. And you'll say, I want you to forget that afterwards. But here is essentially my card and PIN. Go to the shops, buy the groceries, and come back. The digital wallet sharing of a card is the equivalent. So you're saying, in your digital wallet, you can load my card with my details. And then I'm essentially giving you the PIN by letting you use your biometrics. And I think that's where customers are going, but how did you authenticate it? I'm saying, you handed the card and PIN away at the very beginning. The ability to load the card into that wallet is giving them the authority to use biometrics and not a PIN. We have seen various issuers in market take different approaches. You know, some want to use a selfie to do that onboarding, so you can't load a card until the selfie is done. We've seen people request PIN now at point of sale, which somewhat mitigates the convenience of having a wallet in the first place. You want to tap and go. you want to do this as quickly as possible without having to pull out a wallet and several cards. But that upfront loading of your card into that wallet and the in-app approvals you're giving are essentially saying, I give them authority to use their biometrics to authenticate my purchases.
Okay. I think that's now, you know, quite clear on that end. And I like the example that you gave, you know, the literal example of sending someone to the shops with your card and your PIN. And then I think the other one is virtual cards. Right. I'm here to be taught, I'm here to learn, I'm here to be educated, and I'm sure that there's others that are also keen to understand this. What is a virtual card exactly? Right. Is it simply a digital representation of my card that's maybe sitting in an app? Is this the equivalent of a digital wallet with, you know, but just with the banks? Like, what is it exactly?
Sure. I think let's separate to start off, like, the virtual card from the wallet, right? So yes. you mentioned earlier, and maybe for listeners, Apple Pay, Samsung Pay, Garmin Pay, Swatch Pay, all of which end in pays. We're also seeing a transition of those naming conventions from pay to wallet, Samsung wallet, Apple wallet, etc. So any of those that are on a mobile device are generally called your digital wallet. Then a virtual card, which is provided to you in your banking app, to your point, very much a digital representation of having a physical card in your wallet, okay, like your physical wallet, you know, or in your pocket. But the benefit there is that because the details are digital and not physical or stored on a chip, we're able to amend certain details as we wish. For an example, you can rename your virtual cards as you go. You can create a new one every day with a new name, as opposed to have a single card with one name. You can change the limits or the number of transactions that a virtual card can do, which you can't necessarily do on your physical cards. But the main thing that we like to punt from an F&B perspective, and very much from a fraud perspective, is the changing CVV. So the CVV is the value on the back, the three numbers that you use to complete your e-commerce transaction. So at checkout, they'll say enter your card number, your expiry, and your CVV. That CVV for us actually changes based on varying times, depending on our products, just to keep the fraudsters guessing. But that CVV will change continuously after your transactions to make it very difficult for the fraudster to use those card details again, right? So I may be entering it onto a fake website, but in 10 minutes time, if that fraudster does not enter it elsewhere or try and use it themselves, in 10 minutes time, 15 minutes time, that CVV is going to be changed and you're no longer able to use those card details.
Okay. So when it comes to the spectrum of security, because if we're going to have cash on the one side, and then digital payments on the other. And, you know, in the other, you have various forms. You've got the wallets, you've got e-commerce, you've got the digital wallets, and then you've got virtual cards on this side, right? On that spectrum, what tends to be the safest? I think that's where we could possibly end today's conversation, understanding out of everything we've spoken about today, what's currently posing the least risk, for banking customers?
I think to make it simple, cash is always going to be difficult to beat from a convenience and speed point of view, as I mentioned in the beginning. I can hand it to you faster than I can whip out my phone and make a payment to you. And we're seeing people make payments faster and faster and easier from a fraud side. That obviously worries us because we've got to put in faster and faster controls and try and solve for that. When it comes down to it, which payment is validating you as the individual the most? We look at those securities that come with facial biometrics that allows the bank to be very sure of who you are. It gives us the ability to dispute your transactions, which you can't do in a cash environment. Nor can you make payments to, as I mentioned, the Netflixes, the Amazons of the world. You would never be able to do that in cash. They won't do cash on delivery. They're generally all digitally based, so there's no way to get that cash to them. They won't accept an envelope via the post. So simplistically said is you can't beat speed and convenience, but the card and the digital payments allows you to be verified far better in terms of security, gives the bank the ability to go and dispute transactions on your behalf and question the legitimacy of where those funds went, which you wouldn't be able to do in a cash environment. And it gives you a far broader spectrum of ways to pay and merchants to pay and take part in a digital economy that a simple 100 Rand note would not allow you to do.
And on the digital payment side, of the different ones that we spoke about, which one tends to be the most secure?
We see across the base that the customer, as I mentioned earlier, was the weakest point. There's no difference in technology between them. And we don't see any changes in statistics of fraudulent events across the wallets. It's more about the customer and the controls that we have in place. And the customer identifying that they're in a moment of stress or a fraudulent scenario and actually questioning why they're loading certain details or handing them over the phone. It's very much wallet agnostic.
All right. So it has been a really great discussion. And this is where we land today's conversation, just talking about digital payments and the security thereof. Highlighting the fact that, yes, cash continues to be one of those things that people, you know, value because of the speed and the convenience, like what Chris was saying. But at least in the realm of digital, there are some safeguards, that people do have in place, especially if there's been some criminal activity. You're more likely to then, to possibly get your funds back in a digital environment as opposed to cash. I like what he said at the start of the conversation, because he said, when your cash is gone, your cash is gone. Like, there's nothing that anyone, can do about it to replace it. And also just giving us a sense of the different ways in which we have criminal actors acting right now in terms of trying to defraud people, trying to get, illegitimate payments to be passed through, make them look legitimate. And he was talking about, e-commerce platforms and, some of the scams that are there, where people make it seem as if your details are being entered into a legitimate looking platform, whereas it's a mirror that's actually going, to their own pockets as opposed to the merchant website. Also got into conversations, about POS devices. And, some of the things that people do and say on that front when it comes to tapping. But he says that out of all of the different things that they see, that's probably the one that's, has the least action, in South Africa, because of some of the safeguards that are there when it comes to actually getting a POS machine in someone's hands, and then moving into the realm of digital wallets. And the biggest point that he made is that, if someone intercepts the entering of a card onto one of these platforms, Garmin Pay, Samsung Pay, Apple Pay, whatever the pay is, obviously the naming conventions have started changing towards wallet. Then, it's like giving someone your card and writing your PIN on a piece of paper in the physical world, and that person will be able to authenticate and authorize transactions on their own end, because you've given them all of the tools that they need, to make something like that happen. Ending off, of course, talking about virtual cards, but with everything that we've spoken about in the digital world, he does say that it is the individual at the end of the day that is the biggest point of vulnerability. Doesn't matter what the technology is, as long as the individual is the one that needs to be aware of what's going on with their money. So that's been it. Chris, thank you so much for being with us today and for educating us.
Thank you very much for having me. And if I can slip in one more thing or two, I guess, yes, just to tell users that obviously when you talk fraud, it always makes things a bit scary. But in actual fact, digital wallets with all of the security measures are very safe, as long as you're loading your own card into your own wallet. So customers must feel very safe about doing that. Customers must also watch out for the scams, the fake SMSs where we're clicking links and we're entering card numbers, not actual websites or apps, you know, that are provided for the same merchants. And customers must be aware, read their in-app notifications, you know, double check when something doesn't seem so legitimate, and feel free to contact the bank via secure chat and on various channels if they do have questions, because we're obviously happy to assist there. I'm sure any bank in SA is, but just in general, they're not alone in this world, and our fraud teams and our service channels are always there to assist if something doesn't seem 100%.
So you heard it right there. That was us. We were in conversation with Chris Boxall. He is the head of card transact and fraud detection over at FNB. And that's been it for this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcasts on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter with hashtag BD Spotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your pods casted. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail. And this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So from myself and the rest of the team, it is a good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.